Oil prices nudged toward $100 a barrel after reported strikes on Saudi energy infrastructure. Welcome to Debug the Hype. I'm Alex Morgan, and this show is not affiliated with Reddit or any subreddit. Today's date is September 8, 2026. That oil move is the immediate market shock. What follows are the diplomatic and political moves that could reshape whose lives and wallets matter this winter. President Trump posted on Truth Social that Bombardier will no longer be allowed to sell in the United States unless it moves production stateside, a direct threat to a company that, by its own account, relies on roughly 2,800 U.S. suppliers. This is more than rhetoric. Cutting Bombardier off would ripple through U.S. factory lines that build wings, avionics, and other parts. So watch suppliers and regional labor markets for early pain. If this is political leverage, it's a blunt tool that risks hurting American workers tied into a North American aerospace supply chain. Sweden confirmed a roughly 7 billion krona purchase of U.S. HIMARS rocket launchers, with deliveries starting in 2027, and signed a letter of intent with Finland on cooperation for rocket artillery. The concrete anchor here is the price tag and the timeline, just over 10 launchers and a substantial ammo package, which signals a longer-term investment to harden NATO's northern flank now that Stockholm is a member. Expect closer logistics and shared munitions planning. The kicker is geopolitical. This raises interoperability and, yes, the risk of further Russian ire.
Asheville, North Carolina flipped the usual housing script. A construction boom left the city with nearly 3,000 units under construction in 2025, potentially raising stock by more than 12%, and rents were already down about 2.3% year-on-year by 2024. Landlords are cutting rents and offering incentives because supply finally caught up with demand. The lesson for policy? More housing can cool prices, but timing and local shocks matter. If you overbuild into a recession or tourism slump, vacancy and owner losses follow. Start with KEEV and a message that could change the winter. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said he received word from two U.S. envoys, Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff, that the Russians are ready to negotiate. The envoys had just met Vladimir Putin in Moscow, then flew to KEEV to brief Zelensky for hours. What changed today is not only the content of the message, but who delivered it. Envoys closely tied to U.S. President Donald Trump, without the usual State Department fanfare, carrying a potentially game-changing signal that Moscow might be open to talks. Why that matters now? Winter has been a recurring pressure point in this war. Russia has repeatedly targeted energy infrastructure, heating, electricity, to leverage civilian suffering into political pain. A Russian willingness to negotiate over the cold months could, if genuine, produce a tactical pause that spares lives and stabilizes supply lines for heating and electricity. The immediate anchor? Zelensky said in his public remarks that without dialogue, we will not achieve results. But he also stressed caution, noting recent escalations and warning that Russians have used pauses before for force buildup. So KEEV's posture combines a cautious openness with an insistence on verification.
There are three risks in play. First, the broker and motive risk. When envoys tied to a particular U.S. presidential network carry the olive branch, Kyiv worries about hidden bargains or pressure for concessions that might undercut its battlefield gains and territorial claims. Second, the verification risk. What exactly would a pause include? A cessation of strikes? A halt to targeting of energy infrastructure? Safe corridors? Past temporary cessations have collapsed amid accusations of violations. Third, the domestic political risk inside all capitals. Any perceived sellout will provoke backlash in Kyiv, Washington, and across European allies who have invested blood and treasure in different expectations for the war's outcome. Practically, a winter pause could look like several models: a narrow humanitarian arrangement limited to power plant repairs and fuel deliveries, a deconfliction window around key transport and heating infrastructure, or a broader time-bound ceasefire attached to talks at the UN General Assembly in New York. The reporting suggests Washington is exploring trilateral talks: Ukraine, the U.S., Russia, possibly tied to the General Assembly schedule. That's plausible because the UN offers a visible venue where moratoria can be staged and monitored. But the devil is in the verification. Who inspects, who enforces, and what penalties exist for violations? Absent robust, neutral monitoring, any pause could be tactical cover for rearming and repositioning.
Remember the incentives. For Moscow, a winter pause buys time to restock missile and drone inventories and reconstitute logistics, while downgrading immediate pressure on populations at home suffering fuel shortages. For Kyiv, a verified pause could save civilian lives and stabilize power grids, a strategic objective that is morally and politically hard to reject. For the U.S., there is a double-edged element. Securing a pause reduces immediate humanitarian suffering, but American political actors tied to the envoys may be pursuing outcomes that don't align with European or Ukrainian long-term aims. That mismatch could fracture allied cohesion if side deals are perceived. Now switch scenes to Gaza, a follow-up to a story we covered earlier this week with a fresh and alarming development. CBC reports that Israel's defense minister told U.S. officials the Israeli government is prepared to remove Palestinians from the Gaza Strip if Washington gives its approval. This is new because earlier coverage focused on unauthorized West Bank outposts. This report expands the potential scope to Gaza and to forcible moves that humanitarians and legal experts warn could amount to unlawful transfer. Put bluntly, a plan to move large numbers of civilians out of Gaza would be a major operational and legal rupture. The concrete legal anchor here is the standard cited by international law experts. Forcible transfer of a civilian population is unlawful in both international and non-international armed conflict unless it meets strict, narrow humanitarian evacuation standards. Human Rights Watch and other legal bodies have been clear in past analyses. Mass displacement carried out without genuine, voluntary consent and without adequate safeguards for safety, housing, and basic needs risks meeting the threshold for serious violations, potentially a war crime.
There are three immediate questions any responsible planner should answer before even using the word evacuation. 1. Where would people go? Gaza is a strip bordered by Israel and Egypt, both of which have complex political positions and security concerns. 2. Who would guarantee safety, food, water, and medical care during and after the move? The territory's infrastructure is already shattered. Moving people without a parallel plan to provide services invites catastrophe. 3. What are the exit routes and logistics? Mass movement requires transport, staging areas, humanitarian corridors, and international monitoring, none of which are trivial in an active conflict zone. Politically, tying this to U.S. approval is consequential. If Washington were to be seen as enabling or green-lighting population movement, it would expose the U.S. to unprecedented legal and reputational risk, and could fracture alliances that demand adherence to international humanitarian law. It would also intensify outrage among diplomatic partners and international institutions whose legitimacy depends on clear red lines against forced displacement. There are scenarios to consider beyond the headline. One is a narrowly framed, time-limited, temporary relocation of specific populations from immediate combat zones to safer internal shelters, a humanitarian evacuation agreed to by all sides and monitored by neutral agencies. That would be hard, but not impossible, and international law provides space for voluntary, consent-based evacuations with safeguards. The other scenario, broader removal without durable safety guarantees or without genuine consent, would look like coerced transfer and invite legal action, sanctions, and isolation.
Operationally speaking, if such a plan had any chance of being executed without spiraling into an international crisis, it would require buy-in from multiple actors. Israel for security and logistics, the U.S. for diplomatic backing and likely power projection or monitoring assets, the UN and major NGOs to manage aid flows, and Egypt as a transit or receiving point if movement across borders were contemplated. Each of those actors has constraints. Israel, for example, has long resisted large refugee inflows and has its own domestic political calculus. The UN is already stretched thin. NGOs warned they lack the capacity to handle mass, rapid displacement inside a collapsing humanitarian space. Finally, consider the moral and strategic paradox. even if displacement temporarily reduces immediate casualties in active battle zones, it risks destroying any prospect for durable rights-based settlements and could entrench demographic and political divisions for generations. That is why legal and humanitarian red lines exist in the first place, to avoid tactical choices that create intractable, long-term harm. So where does that leave us? Both deep stories converge on a central winter dynamic. Pressure to reduce immediate suffering collides with long-term strategic and legal costs. A negotiated pause with Russia could save lives if verified. A displacement plan in Gaza could also reduce short-term casualties, but only at potentially catastrophic long-term costs. Both choices depend on verification, international monitoring, and who gets to set the terms.
A few practical watch items across both stories. Watch for any operational language about monitors. Whether the International Committee of the Red Cross or UN observers are named, because that's the clearest signal a pause or evacuation is meant to be verifiable. Second, look to public messaging. If Zelensky speaks guardedly and demands specific guarantees, that's an indication Kyiv won't accept vague assurances. Third, watch capital politics. Any sign that the U.S. is privately offering quid pro quos without allied consultation will lower trust and make multilateral enforcement harder. I'll add one community note worth keeping in mind. Online threads, including in the geopolitics community, reacted with a mix of cautious hope and deep skepticism. Hope that stopping winter suffering might be possible, skepticism because past pauses have been weaponized. That split is predictable, but it underlines the political penalty for misframing any deal as permanent peace rather than a time-bound humanitarian measure. Across both stories, the practical framework that separates constructive action from dangerous shortcuts is transparency. Name the monitors, define the triggers, and set clear and forcible penalties for violations. Without that, temporary fixes become permanent catastrophes. If diplomacy is measured in words on paper and decisions at night, the two big questions this week are who signs the pause and who pays the price for it. I'm Alex Morgan from Debug the Hype.